morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Nathan Newcomer. He is with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and here to talk to us about the wild lands of our state. Welcome.
Good morning, Mary Shirley. How are you?
Good to have you. We had you on the air a few years ago, and it's going to be great to have an update today. First of all, what is the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance?
Well, the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance is New Mexico's only statewide conservation organization dedicated to wilderness preservation in New Mexico. We are a nonprofit 501c3. We have over 5,500 members in the state of New Mexico, making us one of the largest organizations. And really what sets us apart from other groups is that we are a grassroots advocacy campaign. If you are a person that cares about protecting wildlands and wildlife, then we are your organization. We are an organization about people who come together to build alliances and build bridges to protect wildlands.
And it's an organization about people to preserve places so they're not so full of people.
Well, you know, wilderness is it's about protecting nature for nature's sake, for sure, but it's also about protecting wilderness areas for people as well, so that people can understand and have a connection to the importance of protecting these areas.
Now, what is wilderness as opposed to other kinds of designation?
Well, wilderness is probably the best form of protection that you can have for a natural landscape. It prevents from having off-road vehicles from going in there. You can't have oil and gas development. You can't do logging. You can't do any kinds of construction of any kind. No motorized access is another key component. However, you can hunt in wilderness areas. You can horseback. You can camp, hike. There's this kind of misconception that wilderness locks the land up, which it doesn't. It actually just preserves it so that it can maintain its primeval character.
How big of a problem is the entrance of motorized vehicles?
It actually is quite an issue, especially up around the Santa Fe area. We do a lot of service projects across the state every year where we bring out volunteers and we work with the federal agencies, the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, and the Forest Service to close illegal roads that off-road vehicle groups are using to go into wilderness areas or potential wilderness areas. And right now there's actually a process going on called a travel management rule. People in Santa Fe might be aware of this issue because it's been going on for the past several months. All of the forest areas in New Mexico are going through the travel management rule process, which basically means that the Forest Service is looking at all of the routes that off-road vehicles use in our national forest, and they're trying to determine which routes to keep open and which ones to close. Now, there's been a lot of people in New Mexico, especially in Santa Fe, who have been really, you know, upset with off-road vehicle abuse that's been going on. It's been outrageous what's been happening.
What's the nature of that abuse?
It's people going off trails, it's people abusing trails, it's people making their own trails, going off designated routes, destroying wildlife habitat, riparian zones, particularly for streams and wetlands. And so what we've been doing is trying to organize people to participate in the travel management rule process. The Santa Fe process is kind of wrapped up, but they're going to be issuing a proposed action in early 2008 where the public will have an opportunity to comment. They're proposing 30-day public comment period, but we're trying to bump that period up to 90 days to give the public a lot more opportunity.
So, I think when you use vehicles in an area that people are using for trails, it's sort of incompatible with other uses.
Yeah, you know, quiet recreation is something that many New Mexicans can enjoy. You know, we go outdoors because we want to get away from the traffic, we want to get away from the big city. And then when we go out to a wilderness area and then we start seeing and hearing a bunch of off-roaders causing a lot of havoc, it's not a lot of fun. And a lot of people are really upset with what's going on. We took a group of people back to Washington, D.C. with us a couple months ago. People that lived in Jemez Springs, people that lived in Santa Fe, people that lived in Albuquerque. And we took them to meet with our congressional delegation to let them know this is a real issue that we're really concerned about. And the congressional delegation was very sympathetic and listening and is going to keep a close eye on this.
Well, the people who ride those things are probably having an awful lot of fun while doing it.
Oh, you know they are. I mean, they get off by, you know, trying to climb up that rock that you couldn't get over, you know, before, trying to go up this cliff that you couldn't get over before. So they're really not just going on one trail, you know, going straight. They're really going around, making a big mess and tearing things up. So it's a big issue.
So what are some of the other threats to wilderness area? I know grazing is a big issue that you guys work with.
Actually, grazing isn't much of an issue that we work on per se. just because grazing and wilderness are compatible. The Wilderness Act of 1964 explicitly states that if there is grazing going on prior to an area being designated as wilderness, that grazing can continue. If grazing is not going on in an area prior to it becoming wilderness, then grazing will never happen. But we do have run into some conflicts with some ranchers, especially down in southern New Mexico, where the Doniana County campaign, where we're working to protect the majestic Oregon Mountains and over 300,000 acres of wilderness quality lands. We've basically seen about 12 ranchers and a few off-road vehicle groups hijack the campaign to protect these areas, where there's a broad consensus from local elected officials to business leaders, religious community. A lot of people who want to protect these wild lands, but we have these radical people who are really trying to change the frame of the debate. And ultimately, their goal is to privatize all public lands. And so we're really facing a big problem down there. But as I said, we have the predominant support of the community down there. So things are looking pretty good down there in that respect.
What about mining?
Mining is an issue. In fact, there's going to be... Our listeners should be aware that there's going to be some work being done by our organization on the 1872 mining law, which is a Civil War era law that basically gives mining companies and foreign companies, for that matter, the opportunity just to come in and lay stake and claim to our public land at a very, very cheap rate, and then leave the taxpayer, us, to foot the bill for cleaning up after their mess. We haven't seen much of that going on lately, but mining claims are starting to go up here in New Mexico, particularly with uranium mining on the Navajo Reservation. So there'll be a lot of work coming up next year as it pertains to mining law reform.
The 1872 mining law is still in effect just as is, including around uranium mining?
Yeah, it's still in effect. There's been some minor changes to it, but ultimately it's still the same law that was passed back in the Civil War. So it's a really outdated, archaic law that needs to be changed. In fact, the House of Representatives recently passed a reform of that law, and we're looking to call on our senators, Pete Domenici and Jeff Bingaman, to take the issue up in the Senate next year and come up with some comprehensive legislation to change that law.
And what would it look like, the new legislation?
Well, for one, it would make companies pay their fair share for cleaning up the sites that they degrade. Because right now, the taxpayer, we are foot with the entire bill. These guys walk away scot-free with it, and we're basically giving away our gold to these guys for free, and we get stuck paying for cleaning up after our dirty water and, just the reclamation of the site itself and the environment.
We're talking to Nathan Newcomer of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Oil and gas development, that's a big one. A lot of conversation about that here in Santa Fe because of the proposed drilling in the Galisteo Basin.
Yeah, the Galisteo Basin is an interesting issue for us because we support the Galisteo Basin, the people that are trying to fight that. But as a wilderness organization, we don't focus on issues that are outside the public domain, where the Galisteo Basin issue involves private land and state land. And so we're not engaged in that issue, but we fully support what the community of Santa Fe is rallying around now. On Otero Mesa, for example, where it's predominantly public land out there and actually represents the largest potential wilderness area left in New Mexico, we're fighting tooth and nail to prevent oil and gas development out there. And for the past 10 years, we've been successful in doing that.
So tell us about Otero Mesa. What is the land there like, and what is the issue around the land?
Well, Otero Mesa, many people consider it to be the Serengeti of the Southwest. It's 1.2 million acres in size, making it the size of Yellowstone National Park and the size of the state of Delaware. It's a huge, huge area. Imagine grasslands that come up to your waist that spread miles upon miles upon miles. You've got over 1,000 native wildlife species that live in Otero Mesa, including pronghorn, mule deer, mountain lion, the endangered Oplomato falcon, over 250 species of migratory songbirds. You've got thousands upon thousands of ancient archaeological petroglyph sites on the volcanic Cornuthas Mountains that are out there. And you've also got the Salt Basin Aquifer, which is the largest aquifer left in the state of New Mexico that has been estimated conservatively to contain enough water to supply a city of 1 million people for 100 years. So it's a really unique area. It's a very special area. And again, we've been working on that issue for 10 years. And to this date, there has been no drilling in Otero Mesa. But the BLM is actively moving forward with trying to issue leases and permits to drill in Otero Mesa today.
Now, that is Bureau of Land Management land.
Correct.
And what are the rules around Bureau of Land Management land?
Well, it varies from area to area. In the case of Otero Mesa, when the whole process began, the BLM wanted to basically open the entire area to oil and gas development with very few regulations and stipulations. Well, once we got involved, they quickly changed that, but they still did not require the regulations and stipulations that we feel are adequate enough to protect the environment and the aquifer. In fact, the there's an environmental analysis or assessment, that the BLM recently issued that the public can comment on right now until January 15th. This environmental assessment is looking to approve a new well in Otero Mesa to be drilled by a company called Harvey E. Yates Company, or HACO.
Now, oil well?
It's a gas well.
Gas well.
It'd be a gas well. So this environmental assessment was released, but the whole premise of the environmental assessment assumes that HACO is going to get a waiver on oil and gas waste pits in Otero Mesa. Back in 2000...
What is it? Yeah, tell us what that means.
Yeah, back in 2006, there's a state agency called the Oil Conservation Division. It's a sub-agency of the Mexico Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources Department. They held public hearings on banning waste pits, oil and gas waste pits that have toxins and hazardous materials in them, in the Chihuahuan Desert grasslands of Otero Mesa. Broad support for that regulation. So that was passed, and Governor Richardson strongly supported that, so a lot of credit's due to the governor on his efforts for that. So the OCD, Oil Conservation Division, banned waste pits in Otero Mesa. Harvey E. Yates Company went to the OCD and said, hey, we want to get a waiver from this waste pit rule. And OCD said, that's not the point. The point is to ban these things. It's not to give you a waiver for this. So HACO is now going to the state Supreme Court trying to get a waiver from these waste pits. Meanwhile,
on the basis of?
Saying that if they don't have it, then they can't drill out there. So, meanwhile, the BLM is moving forward with an environmental assessment, assuming that HACO is going to get this waiver from the state Supreme Court.
Mm.
It's completely irresponsible for the BLM to be doing that. And so we're asking the public to comment on this environmental assessment and tell the BLM they need to go back, redo their analysis, and assume that HACO is not going to get this waiver, since that would be basically breaking state law. And that's something that, you know, we definitely don't advocate.
You know, there's a lot of issues about which this people of the state have a right to comment, or the people of the country have a right to comment. And I think a lot of people don't really know how to do it, or they feel that if they do it, they're just taking somebody else's words, because we're not all experts on whatever that issue is. On this issue, for example, how do people go about commenting on it and have that commentary really be substantial?
Look, it's really clear. You don't have to be an expert, and I try to say that to as many people as possible. Being a grassroots organizer with a lot of people, and I hear that all the time, people are afraid, they're intimidated, they feel like they have to know everything, and that's not true. All you have to do is just understand the issue a little bit, and understand where your passion, where your heart is, what your concerns are, and just come out and say, look, I don't think it's appropriate for us to be drilling in Otero Mesa. I don't think it's appropriate for the BLM to be issuing this permit out there while, you know, ignoring state law. I think it's important for us to protecting our water and protecting our wildlife. Just a real simple message is all you need to do. It's all you have to have an impact, because when you combine that message with the message of one other person and 10 other people and 100 other people and 1,000 other people, then that message is going to get across clear, and that's how you really affect change in policy on managing our wildest public lands.
And you've seen that.
I've absolutely seen that. I mean, with Otero Mesa, again, it's been 10 years since the Bureau of Land Management has proposed drilling out there, and not a single new well has been drilled in Otero Mesa since this whole fight began, and that's been duly from the impacts of the community and all the people that we've been working with across the state.
So on this particular issue, just to close that, how do people go about commenting? I mean, do they go to your website or?
Yeah, they can go to the Mexico Wilderness Alliance website, which is nmwild.org. They can call me personally. My phone number in Albuquerque is 505-843-8696. You can also send me an email. That's Nathan@nmwild.org, and I'd be happy to help anybody who's interested in commenting on this.
So, in terms of Otero Mesa, in the big picture, how are the various interests lining up? In other words, who is for and against? We probably know who is against drilling for oil and gas in Otero Mesa, namely the surrounding public or the public of the state.
Yeah, basically almost the entire population in New Mexico supports protecting Otero Mesa. This year has been a great year for Otero Mesa. We organized a public forum in Alamogordo, New Mexico, which is just north of Otero Mesa, probably the closest community. We had over 250 people turn out to this public forum, and this is a very conservative community. And 250 people showed up showing their support for protecting Otero Mesa and the Salt Basin Aquifer. That was just unreal to see that. You know, cowboys and ranchers, you know, supporting protecting this area. We had letters of support written by Jeff Bingaman, Senator Pete Domenici, and Congressman Tom Udall have all written letters asking that the Bureau of Land Management have a moratorium on drilling in Otero Mesa so that we can study the salt basin aquifer, since we know there's a lot of water out there, but we don't know all the inner workings of the aquifer, the recharge zones are, etc. So we've had a lot of great support from our congressional delegation and from state local leaders as well in the Roundhouse.
And so the local conservative cowboys and ranchers and everybody, what are the issues that they're looking at? Is it primarily the issue of water?
Primarily, I would say it's the issue of water, but it's also about, you know, leaving the land the way it is. They don't want to see the land torn up. And if you just go over the mountain, Guadalupe Mountains on the east side of Otero Mesa, you're in Carlsbad, and you can see firsthand what oil and gas development looks like. We're up in San Juan County by Farmington and Aztec, and you know the environment out in Otero Mesa is kind of harsh. It's kind of windy, and so when you start blading roads and putting pipelines in and industrialization, you have big mounds of topsoil that just can get blown away. And the fragile soils of the Chihuahuan Desert is, it would just not be a good thing for the ranching community out there. So the ranchers are supportive of protecting the area, just not as vocally as I am.
Now, when you look at the BLM from one presidential administration to the next, let's say, for the sake of argument, that a Democrat were elected president in 2008, would the administration of the BLM change? Are those people there for indefinitely?
You mean the employees themselves?
The people who are making decisions about things like Otero Mesa.
Well, I think that, first of all, to answer your question, yes. I think if there was a Democratic president, I think that we would have a much more sympathetic administration to protecting wild public lands like Otero Mesa. You got to remember that when the Bush administration came into office, there was a Cheney Energy Task Force back in 2001. Out of that task force came a directive, an executive order, that mandated all federal agencies to make oil and gas development the number one priority on our public lands over the values of water, wildlife, archaeology. So the BLM right now is under a mandate to expedite oil and gas leases on public lands, and that's why we've seen this huge push for oil and gas all across the Rocky Mountain West, not just in Otero Mesa, but in Colorado, Montana, and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska.
We're talking to Nathan Newcomer of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Anything else that you want to let people know about Otero Mesa?
Got to get down there. That's the big thing. When you get down there, it'll really steal your soul.
And really?
Yeah, it's a beautiful place.
I've heard that one of the reasons it's been hard to really get wilderness protection for Otero Mesa is because it's not so very beautiful, unlike some other parts of New Mexico that have babbling brooks and trees with bambis and stuff, that this is more of a, harsh area. I haven't been there.
Sure. I mean, a lot of people think that. When people think of wilderness, they think of high mountain peaks with streams and trees and elk and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But grasslands are the most threatened ecosystem in the world. They've been degraded, they've been plowed under, we're growing crops on most of those grasslands now. Otero Mesa represents the largest and wildest black gramma grassland left on public lands in the world, in America. I mean, it is a truly special, unique place. And when you get out there and you just experience the vastness of it all, and you're driving on one of those roads and you see golden eagles fly right in front of you, you see herds of pronghorn running by you, you see, the grasslands again up to your waist, it really is a special place. You start to say, hey, wow, I didn't know these places even existed, let alone right here in New Mexico. You would think this would be Africa or something, but it's right here.
A lot of New Mexico used to be grassland.
Right. A lot of New Mexico was grasslands, especially southern New Mexico, but what happened was there was a lot of grazing that occurred back in the 1800s, cattle and sheep. And then we had a really heavy rainy season, and it basically washed a lot of the topsoil away, and so the grasslands could not really establish themselves again. And then you had bushes like creosote and mesquite come in that took over the landscape. And so, yeah, very, very few grasslands are left. And that's why Otero Mesa is, again, one of the most important places that we need to be working on.
When people talk about oil and gas development, one thing that I don't hear so often is just the question of global warming. In other words, every drop of gas or oil that you take out of the ground contributes to our eventual demise.
Right. I mean, that's another great argument to make. We can drill in Otero Mesa. We could drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We could drill in my backyard if there was oil and gas, your backyard, everyone's backyard. At the end of the day, we're never going to be able to drill our way to energy independence. We have to start actively pursuing changing our lifestyles, and Congress needs to start actively pursuing legislation to curb our dependence on fossil fuels and curb our dependence on foreign sources of oil. The Senate is now taking up energy legislation. They've passed CAFE standards, which are corporate average fuel economy for raising miles per gallon for vehicles, but they're refusing to include a renewable energy portfolio standard, which would mandate that public utilities provide a certain percentage of their electricity to consumers from renewable energy by a certain day. And that doesn't make any sense. It's going backwards. We need to be going forward. And so we do need to get some strong leadership and people thinking like that.
So another question is the question of logging on public lands.
Right.
On a wilderness area, you can't log. Is that correct?
No, you can't. You can't log in a wilderness area. No, you cannot. If there's like a fire, for instance, in a wilderness area, generally the fire is allowed to burn. If the fire is threatening human life or health, then special exceptions can be made to go in there and fight that fire, you know, with a road perhaps or with logging. But logging does not occur in wilderness areas. In fact, Mexico really doesn't see much of a logging issue like other states up in the Northwest. So we don't really have to worry about that too much.
So we have in New Mexico 26 designated wilderness areas. What are the most important areas that you would consider the largest and most important wilderness areas in New Mexico?
Well, the Gila is definitely probably one of the most important wilderness areas in New Mexico. First of all, the Gila is the first wilderness area that was ever designated in the entire country. New Mexico is the birthplace of wilderness. The Wilderness Act began here in New Mexico.
Tell us that story.
Well, the story begins back in the 1920s when Aldo Leopold, great visionary conservationist, was working for the Forest Service down in the Gila and also in Arizona, in that part of the country, and realized that it was important for us to protect land for land's sake, because we needed it, because we saw that there was a lot of logging going on, we saw there was a lot of mining going on, and there weren't very many places left. And so he had this vision of protecting large expanses of land where a person could horseback through for a week without seeing a road. And so he came up with the primitive area kind of analysis. And the Gila was designated as a primitive area in 1924. It wasn't until 1964, under the leadership of our former Senator Clinton P. Anderson and the vision of a lot of other conservationists across the country, to establish the Wilderness Act of 1964, which set up the wilderness preservation system in the country, and which has now been adopted by other countries like in Europe and South America and Asia. So it's been a very visionary tale. It's something we should be proud of, but what's sad about it is that New Mexico only has 2% of our public land designated as wilderness. We're about the bottom of the rung as it comes to wilderness protection in the state or in the country.
Is that right?
Yeah. Utah,
so we started the whole ball rolling and then right. We sort of didn't roll with it?
Right, exactly. And Utah is the only state that has less than us.
Mm-hmm.
But New Mexico is right at the bottom, basically. And states like California, Montana, there's states even in the East Coast that have more percentage of their public land protected than New Mexico does. So we've got our job cut out for us. And you mentioned 26 wilderness areas. We're working on a lot of other campaigns to designate more land because this is the land of enchantment. And we need to stick up to our name and actually protect more of these places.
So when you talk about designating wilderness area, you're talking about taking public land that is designated in another way right now and basically having stronger rules to really protect it.
Correct.
A lot of New Mexico's land, while it's not wilderness, is in fact public land.
Yeah, there's a lot, except basically for the east side of the state. That's primarily private land, and there's some state land, but Mexico is really a checkerboard. You've got a lot of tribe land, you've got a lot of public land, you've got military land. White Sands takes up a huge chunk of land. You got Forest Service land, which is also public land. But yeah, it's a big checkerboard, but we do have quite a bit of area that is eligible for wilderness designation. Our organization has actually done an inventory of all the Bureau of Land Management land. It was a very comprehensive inventory, on-the-ground field work with thousands of hours of volunteers. We found over a couple million acres of public land that's qualified for wilderness designation. So some of our campaigns that we're working on now actually include that inventory process that we conducted.
What is the latest piece of land designated as wilderness?
The most recent one was the Ojito wilderness area, which is about 40 miles northwest of Albuquerque, a really kind of badlands, hoodoo-looking landscape. They found the Seismosaurus dinosaur remains out there, which is the largest dinosaur on record, ancient petroglyph sites. It's kind of by the Zia Pueblo, a magnificent area. It's only about 11,000 acres in size, but we worked with the Zia Pueblo to designate that area and then to designate an additional 11,000 acres as a buffer zone around the Ojito Wilderness that was going to be transferred back to the tribe, or to the Pueblo, rather. But it's going to be managed as wilderness, just not officially wilderness.
What kind of relations do you have with the various Indian tribes and pueblos and so on in terms of talking about land use?
I think we have a pretty good relationship with the tribes that we've worked with. We don't work with all of them just because not on all the campaigns we work on have wilderness areas that might be close to tribe land. The Zia Pueblo is probably the most prominent example. We've worked with the Sandia Pueblo as well on Sandia Mountain Wilderness issues a couple of years back. And we've also worked with the Mescalero Apache and with the Tigua tribe out of El Paso on Otero Mesa because they have ancestral claims out there. But the tribes that we have worked with have been great.
So what are the campaigns that you have going right now in terms of designating wilderness areas?
Well, I got to mention probably the closest one here to New Santa Fe is the Sabinoso Wilderness Area. Sabinoso is considered to be the last Great Plains area left in the state of New Mexico. It's about 40 miles east of Las Vegas. Congressman Tom Udall introduced a bill in the House of Representatives this year to designate the Ojito Wilderness, so a lot of thanks need to be sent out to the congressman for that. We've got the support of the San Miguel County Commission to designate that. The city of Las Cruces supports it. Local ranchers that live around the area support it, and in all likelihood, we'll probably see that bill pass in 2008, which would be tremendous, since the Ojito Wilderness Act, which was passed in 2005, from our efforts, was the first wilderness bill designated in New Mexico in more than 16 years. So, you know, it gets back to that whole 2% notion where we have very little public land protected, but New Mexico Wilderness Alliance is actively working to designate more lands. We've got a lot of great campaigns going on, Sabinoso being one of them.
So there's another campaign that has to do with the protection of the Mexican gray wolf.
Right. The Mexican wolf, as many people are aware, is in dire, dire straits right now. We've got less than 25 wild lobos in New Mexico. Less than 25. That is an astounding
That's
figure.
Down, because I thought we had over 100 at one point not too long ago.
No, we never did. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service back in 1998 started the reintroduction effort of the Mexican wolf in New Mexico and in Arizona. They call it the Blue Range Recovery Area, which includes the Gila. The goal of that campaign was to have 100 wild wolves in the wild by 2006. At the beginning of this year, there was 59 wild lobos, and now we're down to less than 25 in New Mexico.
What happened?
They're being removed, they're being killed, they're being shot. There's been a lot of, basically what we're seeing here is this radical bent by a few ranchers down in the Silver City area, down in the Gila National Forest, who again, their goal is to privatize public land. They want to take public land away, and they want to privatize it all. So you have, and what's going on with that as well is we have Congressman Steve Pierce, who's enabling these people. Congressman Pierce is sending out press releases saying that all wild horses in southwestern New Mexico are killed or are dead because of wolves, which is completely inaccurate. You have stories running in the Albuquerque Journal where ranchers are building wolf shelters to guard their children from wolves, which is so ironic because you have more people killed by cattle than they have been by wolves. There's never been one documented case of a person in North America being killed by a wolf. Not one. And so
But they'll cry wolf.
But they'll cry wolf, that's right. And so more people are killed every year by domestic dogs. 60 people are killed every year by domestic animals. You've got people killed in New Mexico by sheep, by horses, by cattle.
By
being kicked, you know. And so it's absurd what's happening. It's outrageous what's happening out there. And what we've been told by our congressional delegation is that they're getting a lot of anti-wolf mail. And so the public really needs to step up to the plate now and just be impassioned and say, look, this is our natural heritage here. We have got to do something to stop the killing of wild wolves. Governor Richardson has been doing a great job. He's issued a moratorium on any removals and killings, but the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is, they're politically corrupted. They're being pressured by Congressman Pierce and by a few radical ranchers, and the public really needs to start speaking out.
And so, again, this leads into the question of, somebody from an area where it's not necessarily so much of an issue. I mean, we don't even have wild wolves in Santa Fe County.
No.
Writing letters about something that's happening in another part of the state without really being close close to it. How do we, you know, how do Santa Feans, for example, get active on that issue?
It's really easy. I mean, I always come back to when I first started getting involved in environmental work. I wrote a letter on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I've never been to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I probably never will be. That's okay. I know it's there, though, and I know it's protected. I know that there's a lot of caribou running wild up there, some they can calf every year. It's the same thing with the Mexican wolf. You don't have to see one. If you can hear one, great. That's wonderful. You're very lucky. If you can see one, you're even luckier. Take a camera and send me a picture when you're done. But, you know, the Mexican wolf is a part of our natural heritage. It was almost exterminated. There were 7 wild lobos back in the 50s, and it was brought back from the brink of extinction. And now we're down to less than 25. Santa Feans can just easily pick up a pen, pick up the phone, make a call, write a letter, and say, I want to see Mexican wolves protected in New Mexico.
Write a letter to Binghamton, Domenici, and Udall? Or?
Write a letter to your representatives. Write a letter to Governor Richardson. Tell Governor Richardson that you would like to see people on the Game and Fish Commission who are pro-wolf. You know, there's a lot of pressure being coming down from these few radical people down there. And it's, you know, again, this is public land that we're talking about. This is Santa Fe's public land. It's not the land of a few ranchers down in southwestern New Mexico. This is our land. So these are our wolves. You know, this is our family. You got to look at it that way. So you have a stake. Everyone has a stake in protecting these lobos.
What? I saw a film, and we actually had an interview with some people who made a film about, actually, you sponsored this,
we
Living
sure
with Wolves, which was about a wolf pack that was bred sort of in confinement in Idaho. But one of the things that I thought was interesting that I didn't really know so much before seeing the film was that wolves have a very positive effect on the ecosystem.
Yeah, they sure do. If you look at Yellowstone, for example, wolves were exterminated from Yellowstone. And then what happened was the elk population exploded. And so once the elk population exploded, they started grazing everywhere. And so that started damaging riparian zones, and streams were being eroded. And then disease started spreading amongst the animals. And so, you know, it really took the whole ecosystem out of balance. Once they introduced wolves, wolves started killing and eating the lame elk and the elderly elk and the diseased elk, thereby increasing the herd's vitality and then restoring or making the herds actually move around instead of staying in one valley where they were degrading the grasslands or the streams. And so the wolves were chasing them around. It just brings the whole balance back. So that's absolutely true that wolves do not, you know, there's this whole fear about wolves, you know, attacking people and that they're bad for the environment. They're great for the environment. They keep the environment in check. And so you're absolutely right that wolves do keep the ecosystem in balance.
Why are the ranchers who are grazing their cattle on public land so vehemently against the wolves? I mean, they do eat cattle, I guess.
Well, there has been some instances of cattle depredation, but you can't blame everything on the wolf. You know, the ranchers have got to step up and take some responsibility here. You have issues where cattle, you know, we're talking about the Gila country, very rocky, mountainous country, not ideal cattle grazing country, and it's not a lot of pastures out there. And so cattle typically can fall, you know, break a leg, and so they're stuck. They can't move. Wolf comes along, he sees an alien animal, he's pretty hungry. It kind of makes sense for him to eat that animal. Not, you know, he's not actively chasing cattle down to go kill them. That's not their normal prey. You know, elk and deer are their normal prey and other smaller animals. So, you know, the privatization is really the focus of the ranchers. They just don't want to see public land anymore. And again, Congressman Steve Pierce isn't enabling them. He's an advocate as well of privatizing public land and getting rid of wolves and exterminating the Endangered Species Act altogether.
So when they talk about privatizing public land, what does that vision look like? Into whose hands would public land fall?
Great question. I mean, I think that's you know, we really don't know. If Congressman Pierce, say, were to introduce a bill to privatize public land, maybe they would put a clause in there that they could sell it to, you know, multinational corporations, and you start seeing large corporations coming and buying up big chunks of land, and then, you know, public land that was normally open to you and I to go out and camp and do whatever we wanted to, now you've got to pay, you know, a $200 pass to get to every year or something like that.
Well, it could be anything. I mean, it could be oil
anything.
And gas,
yeah.
It could be golf courses.
Anything
you
want, yeah.
But, I mean, I suppose that vision that they're talking about includes, would have public land going into the hands of local ranchers.
Probably, yeah. I mean, probably just so that they could expand their enterprise and graze everywhere with whatever stipulations and regulations they wanted to.
It's funny, I was talking to a relative who's actually a rancher in Pinedale, Wyoming, over Thanksgiving, and she was talking about both how terrible the gas development is there and how the gas fields have ruined the area in which she's been ranching for her entire life, the last 40 years. And then also, she was talking about wolves and how bad wolves are. And I said, well, you know, in New Mexico, when a rancher loses a cow or whatever, they're compensated. She goes, well, we're compensated too, but it's the pride of it. You just don't want your herd, anybody in your herd killed.
That's really interesting. I think you're right. You know, I think that there is that pride amongst ranchers down in southwestern New Mexico where they just don't want to see wolves, period.
Yeah.
You know, that's why they're doing these ploys by building these wolf shelters for their children, doing these outrageous things, and pushing this agenda of privatization. So I think you're absolutely right. I think your friend's absolutely right in Wyoming as well, that it is that pride issue. But we've got to start standing up for Mexican lobos. It's just, we cannot let this animal go extinct. And with 25 wild lobos, now is the time. Now is the time to stand up and be counted.
So what would protection of that animal look like?
Well, full recovery would be one step. You know, the Fish and Wildlife Service has a mandate under the Endangered Species Act to fully recover the Mexican gray wolf population. Again, they were supposed to have 100 wild lobos in the wild by 2006. We had 59 at the beginning of 2006. So the Fish and Wildlife Service, for one, could start doing their job and making sure that we have a viable population of wolves down in New Mexico so we can get the animal off the endangered species list. But right now, that's definitely not going to be happening. Although we are trying, we do see that Congressman Pierce is trying to get rid of the Endangered Species Act. He had efforts this year to amend the Endangered Species Act with legislation that would get rid of the Mexican gray wolf reintroductory program, which would, in effect, kill off the entire species.
We're talking to Nathan Newcomer of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Let's talk about the values of wilderness. You know, you were talking about Aldo Leopold and the vision of wilderness that came. That came for a reason. The now United States was all wilderness, and then the kind of expansion that happened in the West made very large changes very, very rapidly, shocking not only the Native Americans who were here, but even the pioneers who were coming from the East.
Yeah, I mean, Aldo Leopold, probably the best story to tell about Aldo Leopold and his vision was, and it pertains to wolves as well, was that, you know, back in those days it was very common for people, when you saw a wolf, to pick up your rifle and start shooting. And well, one day Aldo Leopold and a few buddies were sitting up on a ledge in the Gila, and they saw a little pack of wolves down there, and they grabbed their rifles, didn't even hesitate, and started pumping lead down the side of the mountain. When they got down there, Aldo Leopold saw a little pup dragging its leg behind it that had been shot off, and then he saw the mother wolf. And he said he got there just in time to see a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. And he said when he saw that, he knew that it was his life's call to protect wildlands and the wildlife that depend on them. And that's what began his quest. He just knew by taking that life, seeing that fire die, that he had a calling to do. And I think it's a calling that we all have to do. You know, we cannot let that any more green fires die in the Mexican lobo. And the value of wilderness really comes back to, you know, our spirit. It keeps us whole. People, go away from the city to go out to wild places to experience nature. You know, we hike in the Pecos on Hamilton Mesa, and we see all the peaks up there and the wild irises to connect with the land. It brings us back to who we are and recognizes, or it reminds us that, you know, there's a lot bigger things going on in the world than just who we are and how we can make our pile bigger. So wilderness is really, I think, about spirit of the soul.
And I think one of the problems that a lot of people talk about is people in the United States, not to mention the rest of the industrialized world, getting disconnected from nature and the, you know, spiritual and economic detriments that arise from that.
Yeah, you know, one thing that the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance works on to try and change that pandemic is that we're working with high school students and college students across the country, or across the state, rather. To get them engaged in environmental awareness and in basically political participation as well. There was a great book that was written about nature deficit disorder. Nature deficit disorder. I can't remember the author's name. I should remember, but I can't at the moment. Sorry, listeners, but the whole point is basically what you just said, that people are disconnected, and especially our youth are disconnected from wild nature. And so we view it, the Mexico Wilderness Alliance views, it's our job to go to schools and to educate schools, to say, hey, let's get you outdoors, let's talk about environmental issues and how you can make a difference, because your voice does matter. again, because this is public land. This is our land. This is your land. And when you get old enough to vote and when you start getting a job paying taxes, you know, those taxes are helping to pay for a BLM salary employee to manage our public lands for us. So it's important for you to understand what's going on now. And we've been working with students at a charter school in Albuquerque called Amy Beal for 2 years. And this year we had a great student who did a lot of organizing and rallies and brought out hundreds of students to rallies outside, like Senator Bingaman's office, urging him to protect Otero Mesa. You know, they've made signs. She got on the radio, did a whole bunch of cool stuff. And so it really empowered her, and it empowered her friends to say, hey, wow, it's really neat that you could actually do that. I didn't know you could do that. And that's really good to me. It feels great when you can actually see that impact happening with the youth of America.
So you're training young organizers
along with everything
else.
That's right.
Now, do you also take young people out to the land?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a part of our organization is a grassroots advocacy organization, so we do a lot of organizing. But the other part is taking people outdoors. I personally lead hikes across the state every year. And we do service projects, like I mentioned earlier in the program, that we go out to wilderness areas or potential wilderness areas and close off illegal roads an off-road vehicle group might be using. What our listeners should be aware of is that probably within the week, we're going to have our 2008 Wild Guide printed.
This Wild Tell us Guide, about that.
Yeah, Wild Guide is going to, it's basically the passport to New Mexico's wildest public lands. It will outline all of the hikes that our organization leads. It will outline all the service projects that our organization leads. It will have some guided hikes that you can do by yourself. There will be wilderness recipes. There will be safety tips on how to, you know, deal with a snake bite wound or how to waterproof your matches. There will be stories from Congressman Tom Udall, from Senator Pete Domenici, from other people just writing about backpacking. Just a great little guide that's going to be coming out. It's going to be available at REI in Albuquerque. Sports Outdoors in Albuquerque. It's actually sponsored by REI. It's going to be available here in Santa Fe at the Travel Book. It's going to be available in Taos at Mud and Flood. And it'll be available at our offices. And we have offices in Albuquerque, here in Santa Fe, Taos, Las Cruces, and Carlsbad. So we are truly a statewide conservation wilderness organization.
And that being the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and the Santa Fe office is a pretty recent addition.
It sure is. We just opened it up this year, and if I may, I'll put a plug in for David Ehrman, who's our staff person at the Santa Fe office. He's located at 341 East Alameda. He'd be happy to hear from you if you want to give him a call. His phone number in Santa Fe at the office is 216-9719. Again, that's David Ehrman with our office here in Santa Fe.
When people go to wildlife areas, you know, you look on the map, you figure out where your wildlife areas are. There's 26 of them. You go to El País, or you go to Carlsbad or wherever. When you get there, what do you do? Is there always a visitor center the way there are in some places? No.
No, not generally. One of my most favorite wilderness areas is the Apache Kid Wilderness down the San Mateo Mountains. There's practically nothing out there. There may be a few campsites that have some facilities, but predominantly you don't see that. And one of the reasons we don't see that is mainly due to funding limitations, especially with this administration in office. We've had National Park Service budgets been slashed tremendously. A lot of great people are leaving these agencies because they're just fed up dealing with all the crap they have to deal with. But most wilderness areas, they will have like a parking lot generally, and maybe a few campsites. But the point is not to like be on the periphery of the wilderness area. The point is to go into it, to experience it, and to do it primitively, and to walk away with a better understanding.
Now, hang on. What American, how many people can do anything primitively? I mean, you go out with a 50-pound backpack that has, you know, a cook stove and linguine.
Well, they're getting a lot better at making really lightweight stuff. You know, I still have an ancient Kelty backpack, so mine's probably still pretty heavy. But, yeah, I mean, day hikes as well. Yeah, you know, you're right. A lot of people don't do that, but there's kind of a lot of people do that, you know.
What about you? I mean, here you are. Do you go deep into the wilderness with a little backpack on?
I love it. I love it. I love it so much. I need to be going out right now because I've been stuck in Albuquerque for quite too long this year. But, you know, we've got some good holiday season coming up, so I'm trying to maybe go to some hot springs down in the Gila, which would be great. But, yeah, I get out definitely as often as I possibly can. And, again, I lead a lot of hikes for the organization, so I'm taking people out on day hikes to experience wilderness in a day, which is definitely valuable as well.
What do people need to know about leaving the land the way they found it? What are some of the mistakes that you know, well-meaning people make when they go into wilderness land?
Just it's called the leave no trace ethic. You know, just be aware of what you bring in. If you packed it in, you can pack it out. You know, don't, if you bring in a sack lunch or something, don't just throw your plastic on the ground. Don't throw your bag on the ground. Just crumple it up, put it in your pocket, carry it out. I don't really see a big issue with people trashing wilderness areas. It generally comes to campsites when you have those campsites that are on the outside of wilderness areas where people can park their cars and come party. Then you get the problem of people tossing beer cans and things like that. So it's just, you know, just treat it as if it was your own backyard or your neighbor's backyard, rather, and treat it with respect.
I saw the other day, it was for some organization puts out a birding guide. So there are certain areas where you can see certain wildlife and check them off on your list. Do you do that kind of thing?
No, we don't have anything like that, but the wild guide is ever evolving. The 2007, this year's edition, was basically just all of our hikes and all of our service projects, but you know, next year's is going to be even better with all the things that I mentioned, having recipes like how to cook a green chili, chicken enchiladas in a Dutch oven. We did that in Otero Mesa this year. We fed 30 people with this huge pot of green chili, so we're giving people the recipe for that, giving a lot of other recipes for great little dishes on that you can make while you're backpacking or camping in the woods. So we're trying to give people some tips on how to connect with the land, with the wild guide, and maybe we'll have something like that in the following year where we have a little bird checklist, because we do have a new staff member named Steve West down in Carlsbad who is an ornithologist and is a bird expert, and he'd probably love the opportunity to put something together like that. That's a good idea.
We've got about 3 minutes left or so. What do you want to leave people with before we go?
Well, you know, I think that it's important, again, for people to understand who the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance is, that we are a nonprofit, grassroots organization dedicated to protecting and preserving wilderness areas in New Mexico. We actively work to designate new areas, and we actively seek to ensure that existing areas stay permanently protected and that there aren't incursions by off-road vehicle groups or oil and gas industry. And so we are definitely a grassroots organization that wants people who care about wildlands and wildlife to be engaged. We are your avenue to speak out. We organize people to meet with our congressional delegation staff here locally to have your voice heard. We'll help you write letters to the editor. You know, we'll help you craft that letter. We'll help you in any possible way. That's my job. I'm more than happy to help you, because I know that there's a lot of people listening right now that want to protect places like Otero Mesa. They want to protect the Mexican gray wolf, but they just don't know how to do it. But it's really simple, you know, to speak from your heart, follow your passion, and together we can change a lot here in New Mexico protecting the land of enchantment.
Do you partner with other wildlife organizations and wilderness organizations?
Absolutely,
and so on?
Absolutely. New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, you know, it's built in our name. We're all about building alliances and building bridges. We work with a lot of other conservation groups across the state, Forest Guardians here in Santa Fe, we work with them. We work with, you know, again, businesses. We work with religious leaders. We work with local elected officials. We've got a lot of support across the state. So, you know, we're definitely all about building those alliances and bridges.
Each group has a different focus. Do you find that it's easy to build bridges, even though you have sort of different ideas and maybe even to some extent different philosophies?
Oftentimes, I feel like we all have the same goal of protecting the wildlands of New Mexico, ultimately, and their wildlife. Our mission is specifically on wilderness. That's what we focus on. You know, you don't see us really going out, silvery minnow issues or things like that. We're specifically on wilderness. But yeah, I think that everything is connected. And so we definitely don't see a hard time working with other organizations across the state.
Nathan Newcomer is with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. They are on the web at nmwild.org. And his phone number in Albuquerque is 843-8696. He's available at nathan@nmwild.org. And we want to thank you so much for being here this whole hour on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website, santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan, featuring some great pianists and tenor sax players. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, Robert Knott will be here and much, much more. So keep your dial tuned to KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station, 101.1 FM. Hasta la vista. Bye.